So let's go on to the next case. This is a case of Dr. Bill Harwin. I really like the fact this is an 82-year-old woman who went on a randomized trial, actually Sandy's trial, the Cleopatra study. She presented with locally advanced disease, as you'll hear. She knew she had a breast mass, but was taking care of her husband, who unfortunately was dying. Then she came in for treatment, was found to have metastatic disease. He enrolled her on the Cleopatra trial. She gets docetaxel, trastuzumab, and either pertuzumab or placebo. Of course, he doesn't know. She does very well, finishes next the six cycles of docetaxel, goes on the maintenance with trastuzumab and whatever. However, after a year, while doing well, develops a very problematic skin rash that you'll hear him describe, and actually goes to a dermatologist, has a biopsy. They think it's a drug reaction, not sure what's going on, and have stopped therapy and trying to figure out what's going on. I was asking Sandy, actually, whether she'd seen this or even knew about this case on the study. Here's Dr. Harwin talking about the case.
She's a widow, and unfortunately, her husband was ill and passed away a few months before she was diagnosed, and that is why she let the breast mass go. She was aware of the breast mass for a number of months, but she was so busy taking care of her husband and consumed with her husband's illness that she neglected seeking medical attention. She's optimistic, usually in good spirits, is very soft-spoken, very easygoing, and easy to communicate with.
How would you describe her overall general condition and health, maybe compared to other 82-year-olds?
She's 5 to 10 years younger. She's really in very good shape. Fully ambulatory, doesn't need any help getting up on the examining table. Never seen her use a cane, a wheelchair, or any type of walker. She's very fit for early 80s.
What about this rash she had while she was on the study?
It's very pruritic. It almost looks a little bit like scabies. It's not a typical exact drug rash, but it's a very spotty. It's really all over her body, but not confluent. It's sort of scattered. It's maculopapular. She saw a dermatologist multiple times, had skin biopsies, and it appears to be a drug-related rash. Now, whether it's from trastuzumab or the study drug pertuzumab, there's no way for me to know.
So actually, Mark, have you ever seen a bed rash with trastuzumab chemo?
No, I haven't. I mean, certainly the package insert reports rash in trastuzumab-treated patients, and I think around about 20% of patients, but not to this degree.
Okay, so this is real life, as we say, and Dr. Harwin was going to let things settle down and try to get the patient back on trastuzumab, but we'll see what happens. We're just using this as a way to get into the issue of metastatic HER2-positive disease. Joe, what about the patient presenting with ER-positive HER2-positive mets? When we saw the tandem data randomizing patients with ER-positive or HER2-positive metastatic disease to either anastrozole alone or with trastuzumab, everybody got kind of nervous with the patients on the anastrozole alone who didn't do very well. Are there people, as Eric said, that would just give hormonal therapy in these patients, or do you usually combine it with anti-HER therapy?
Endocrine therapy alone is my default position for every patient who has ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, unless I'm forced to either resort to systemic chemotherapy because of symptomatology or disease burden. In a patient who has HER2-positive disease, I think Eric's comments were right on. You can interpret that data any way you wish and make an argument to give trastuzumab or not. My own personal bias would not be to give trastuzumab, but to reserve it for when I need to pull the chemotherapy trigger.
So I want to ask Skip about trastuzumab lapatinib off study. But before we do, Mark, agree, disagree with Joe. You're okay with just using hormone therapy, metastatic ER-positive, HER2-positive disease?
You know, I suppose in an 82-year-old, that would be a perfectly reasonable option with close clinical follow-up. Another reasonable option might be the letrozole-lapatinib combination because it, you know, has been shown to result in increased time to progression, though no survival signal as yet. Though at the time the survival data were reported first for that data set, less than 50% of the mortality endpoints had yet been recorded, so it's still immature. That said, I want to make one point about this case, and that is we have to call Dr. Harwin as soon as we get back to Miami. Because lobular breast cancers are only rarely ever HER2-positive. The only ones I've seen are pleomorphic lobulars, but pure lobulars are essentially never HER2-positive. So I don't know where you find these cases, but this is another challenging one.
Actually, Cliff, you were telling me that you had a case like this that came out of Canada. I don't know if you want to comment.
Oh, no, that's the reverse. That's actually a story about being clinically aware, and this was invasive lobular cancers that were being reported as ERPR negative on a regular basis in eastern Canada, and it led to a gigantic scandal. They were just false negatives.
The only more bizarre case would be someone with a BRCA1 mutation and a lobular cancer that is HER2 positive.
So
now we're getting silly.
So Skip, what about lapatinib, trastuzumab, non-chemo combination? Are there situations where you're using it outside of protocol setting for metastatic disease?
Rarely. I've done it a couple times. It's been in patients that had been through several lines of therapy, intolerant of chemotherapy, didn't think they could handle capecitabine and lapatinib, but I continued it on. But I think that the bang for the buck there is likely to be earlier on if we prove out in clinical trials where that combination is worthwhile.
So I want to get a little bit into the issue of just first-line therapy of metastatic HER2-positive disease, Eric, in a patient who's gotten adjuvant trastuzumab. I mean, a lot of people have gotten trastuzumab now since 2005, so a lot of these people have had it. So we're going to show you what the audience said, but Eric, what would you say? You got a 65-year-old woman, prior node-positive tumor. And so we didn't talk about ER in the neoadjuvant. I need to ask you about that. But anyhow, she gets adjuvant trastuzumab chemo, then develops symptomatic metastatic recurrence in the bones and the lung a year after finishing adjuvant trastuzumab. What would you likely do, Eric, and what kind of anti-HER therapy would you use at this point a year after finishing trastuzumab?
So, I think there are a couple of choices here. You can either start trastuzumab again and give it in combination with some other chemotherapy, or I don't know what she's been given in terms of hormonal therapy, but given the fact that she has asymptomatic disease, this is also someone where, you might possibly consider giving some hormonal therapy with her trastuzumab, or for that matter, letrozole and lapatinib. The other choice would be to move on to lapatinib and to give it in combination with capecitabine. And I would add that I'm a little more flexible about the trastuzumab-lapatinib regimen. And if this woman said, I just had this, really difficult course of chemotherapy a year ago, is there anything you can do for me that doesn't involve getting more chemotherapy at the moment? And if I were not confident that hormonal therapy were going to do anything, I might think about giving her lapatinib and trastuzumab.
Either one.
Yeah.
Or letrozole.
I was saying that if I thought that hormonal therapy wouldn't work.
Was this patient on hormonal therapy, Neil? I assume so.
Yes, we assume so. You can see the audience is a little bit split in terms of what to do. Let me ask you, Eric, after seeing the neoadjuvant data, obviously that was neoadjuvant, but, we saw what seemed to be, as you pointed out, two of the trials, even though one looked a little bit better efficacy for trastuzumab, does that affect your choice in the metastatic setting?
Well, it would affect my choice in a first-line setting, potentially. But here, this is somebody who previously had trastuzumab a year ago. I think of this in a somewhat different light, and I think that you could either treat her with trastuzumab or, in this case, you could treat her with lapatinib.
Mark, can you make your point? But also, there's this issue of how long it's been. We present this case and do 6 months, more likely lapatinib. We make it 18 months, going to more likely trastuzumab. Mark, do you think from the disease-free interval, is that a big factor?
Sure, it may weigh in your decision about which modality to use, but I think a more important point that you touched on was the data presented yesterday about the ER-positive subsets having lower response rates in both of the neoadjuvant combined HER2-targeted agent trials. I just want to point out that was not a feature of any of the adjuvant studies, because in all the adjuvant studies, the patients went on to get standard adjuvant endocrine therapy. Therefore, the hazard ratios in the ER-positive, ER-negative arms were spot on in the adjuvant trastuzumab campaigns. So I wonder if using PCR as just this intermediate endpoint can really uncover differences in intrinsic sensitivity between the various ER-positive and negative subsets, and yet after these patients go on to get their endocrine therapy, that may be erased.
Eric, I was kind of looking at that, thinking about Oncotype, even though it was HER2-positive in genomics, in terms of, is this the ER-positive resistance to chemo thing rearing its head?
Well, we know that HER2-positive cancers in terms of Oncotype are almost always high recurrence score cancers, occasionally intermediate. And just to echo what Mark said, in the metastatic setting, I'm not aware of any evidence that HER2-containing regimens are less effective in patients with ER-positive than ER-negative disease. I made that point yesterday related to PathCR and how predictive PathCR would be in that setting.
I was thinking, maybe the ER negatives have a higher proliferation rate, maybe more sensitive. What about the issue of the new agents coming in particularly TDM1. We asked the audience, if that agent were available right now with the data that we have right now, are there patients in your practice that you'd give it to? And Cliff, more than 3/4 of the audience said yes. What's your answer?
My answer is yes as well, and this highlights what's going to be a real challenge for us going forward. We have essentially two charges. One is to develop more effective therapies, and the other is to develop equally effective therapies that improve on the toxicity side. TDM1, compared to our available options, may well fulfill the latter, and that is not an easy pathway to a regulatory approval. This is an interesting challenge for us as a community.
TDM1 is a great drug, but it just may not be a lot better than chemotherapy and trastuzumab, other than the fact that it is much less toxic.
Well, I mean, that seems...
No, that is better. But unfortunately, the FDA is not as open to approving drugs that are less toxic but equally efficacious in terms of response rates and progression-free survival and overall survival.
We're going to go on to the last case, but a couple quick comments. Mark?
I just want to point out that there was another paper presented at this meeting, which was the pertuzumab TDM1 pilot data. Now, I don't know whether pertuzumab adds anything to the TDM1 or not, and that's not what struck me about the result from that paper. What really got my attention is that in a really heavily pretreated patient population, once again, we see a TDM1-containing regimen with response rates around about 40%, spot on with what was seen with the original phase 2 data set. So this is quite compelling and really exciting and encouraging that this is a very active agent.
And the other part about it is both of the phase 2 trials that we've participated in, I presented one, about 20-25% of the patients centrally reviewed were HER2 normal. So if anything, we're probably getting the low end of the TDM1 activity. I mean, it's certainly not overstated, you know.
No, and response rates were actually higher in the patients who had centrally confirmed HER2 positivity. Although, interestingly, there were a few patients with centrally confirmed or centrally assessed HER2 normal disease who responded to TDM1, which you wouldn't expect.
Although, when the drug first came out, the idea was that if you could simply, maybe those patients that overexpressed the receptor delivered chemotherapy more effectively, you know, that study should get done still. I mean, and obviously being delayed by the FDA issue.
Where are we right now, Cliff? Am I correct in saying the NSABP is actually moving forward with a trial of chemotrastuzumab in, quote, HER2 normal tumors?
That is the story. It has a B number. I personally have said in public, so I'll say it here now, I think it's a bad idea.
Okay. Well, I can't just let that leave before we go to this last case. Mark,
you said it's a bad idea.
What's the bad idea?
I mean,
to look at trastuzumab chemo and HER2 normal. You guys just presented your round robin. Okay. You want to comment on that? Well, did that confirm what Soon Paik showed with the NSABP?
Well, I mean, I think there's very, very compelling data, both in the lapatinib experience in phase 3 and trastuzumab experience in phase 3, that in retrospective analysis, subsequently in the FISH-negative cohorts, there's no signal of efficacy whatsoever in HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer with any of the HER2-targeted agents. Similarly with TDM1, even the retrospective analysis there, the patients with lower levels of HER2 presented at ASCO had a shorter PFS.
Adjuvant.
No, so I'm not talking about
adjuvant. Yeah, the issue in the adjuvant setting is that the local labs called these patients positive and the patients were enrolled. Central labs subsequently called them negative. In one case, Soon Paik showed nicely that their mRNA levels were indistinguishable from control normal cases. It's true. However, uncertainty in the area of testing is the 800-pound gorilla here, and multiple testing increases the possibility that you'll get a false positive or negative, and so you just can't get away from the fact that these patients were called positive somewhere, sometime by somebody before the central lab called them negative. That distinguishes them from an unselected HER2-negative group that's called that locally. We've done a prospective randomized trial with trastuzumab and the CLGB in stage 4 disease, and you just don't see evidence of additivity to chemotherapy. By the way, the EGF study, 3000, I think, 1, whatever it was, the paclitaxel plus or minus lapatinib, excluded HER2-positive cases, found no activity for the anti-HER2 agent, except for the subset of patients who snuck onto the trial unknown to them as HER2-positives. So I just think that we have overreacted to a trivial subset of these adjuvant trials, and it's probably one that won't be corroborated.